So good afternoon, everyone. I already introduced myself, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about the work that Privaterra does, but particularly to give you a better sense of the linkage between privacy-enhancing technologies and a core constituency that I believe really needs to be able to understand these tools better and be able to use them, and this is the human rights community. So what I plan to do over the next few minutes that I have with you is to go through a very quick introduction, some information that I didn't mention when I did my introduction, talk about some of the risks, the threats and vulnerabilities that the organizations that I deal with have, some of the consequences if no actions are taken, some of the tools that are thought by many that could be used and some of the experiences we've had with them. And then I'll try to spend about maybe 3 to 4 minutes to go through a slideshow of what a typical mission is in terms of helping human rights organizations in the field. And if there's time, just to do a very quick summary. What I did mention at the beginning is some of the relationships that Privaterra has with organizations. So what we try to do, and as I mentioned, is we try to kind of be a bridge between different communities. Most of the people who helped establish Privaterra primarily came from a privacy advocacy community, but we realized that in many discussions there was a lot of talk about human rights, but there was little dialogue with the human rights community per se. And so we said, well, it's maybe good to do that, but also link with privacy advocates, security experts, and also developers as well. And so some of the key relationships that have really helped our organization grow and provide us very strategic advice are key human rights organizations, and I won't list all of them here, but the key ones have been Human Rights Watch, the International Center for Transitional Justice, more recently Peace Brigades International, and also some very key human rights networks, including the Northern-based Frontline, which is a human rights defenders network based in Ireland, and Connect Us, which is a human rights network based in the South with headquarters in Brazil. Getting into particular issues that human rights organizations have, from most of the field experience that we've had, it breaks down into very simple things. And I've ordered them in order of frequency that affects users and affects organizations. Most of the biggest complaint from users and the biggest complaint from organizations is the issue of computer viruses. Computer viruses that affect internet cafes that organizations use, it affects the computers that they use, and particularly of concern over the last 2 years are viruses that not only destroy information on a computer, but that randomly select documents on your computer and mail them out to anyone on your contact list. This proved particularly problematic in Guatemala, where an organization not only had government contact, but NGO contacts as well, and their grant proposal of what they wanted to do over the next year was sent to people in the Ministry of the Interior without them knowing. And when they found out, it was a problem because the government then knew what their plans were. The other key issue is equipment breakdown. Unlike these nice facilities here, a lot of organizations have conditions where there's maybe a lot of dust, there's a lot of humidity, and where the power may not be stable. And so it's non-computer factors, maybe having a power supply regulator to make sure that there's current or battery backup. If those things aren't taken care of, then any information that's stored in any way, protected or not, can disappear. And anything that's designed also has to take care of these. And getting into the power and the dust, it's also the physical environment. Environments of a great risk. Some of the organizations have routine break-ins to the organizations by government authorities or non-government authorities, and so you have to think of the computer and the information as a member of the staff, and you protect them as you would any one of the staff as well, but also think if it's raining, if the water will come in through the roof and other things like that as well. Now the first three things, and one thing that I really hate to say, particularly to this crowd and to many others, is one of the key options and one of the things that's really good is to do an analysis of what the people are using and help them with it first. And if you see longer term solutions, to try to help them with it and maybe migrate them to better things. the issue of viruses can be probably very easily fixed, moving them to free and open source systems. But if 99% of the organizations are using proprietary Windows, you can't tell them to switch and not provide a migration and hold their hands. So you can tell them that their virus issue might be solved by moving them to free and open source, but then you really have to think about how you want to do that over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. And so we're trying to address immediate concerns and at the same time thinking about meeting and long-term assistance that we can create linkages to try to help them and for them to find people regionally to help them as well. The other two key issues that occur to organizations is one of surveillance. A lot of the telecommunications infrastructure either has censorship or is routinely intercepted by one or many government authorities or by other people inside the infiltrated in the organization. And because some organizations are beginning to have computer networks at their offices, a lot of the information warfare is being occurring by hacking. So people that remotely try to come in and manage and do things to their content. And so an equation that we always try to think of in terms of talking to the organizations is whatever risk they have is finding out what their threats are, their vulnerabilities, and what capacity they have to deal with them. Some of the consequences that have occurred and that exist and that happen every day in regards to organizations that don't try to think about this before the fact is that interception of communications, be it email, courier messages, or just paper documents that are passed between people, but particularly electronically, is one thinks about in our context is identity theft. So that's something that in Canada and the United States increasingly is something that is a very big problem. I don't think in the developing world maybe identity theft is such a big thing. However, threats and intimidations are. The moment people know that you're doing a particular activity that to some may not be pleasant, you may be warned, please don't do this, or if you do this, you'll be killed, or we'll kill your daughters or your wife and things like that. People have been imprisoned, and as occurred to some people I trained in Guatemala from the Rigoberto Menchú Foundation, Rigoberto Menchú was a Nobel Prize laureate, I believe, in 82 or 92. Someone from her staff, about a year after I did some training for them in 2000, their chief accountant, they got a call that someone was going to die, and the accountant was killed on the spot. And this is an organization that was working for indigenous reform and indigenous rights, and it's very common in many parts of the world. And I'll show you some pictures that won't show people being killed, but some of the environment that exists. But the other thing, too, that's very insidious that if you don't put protection in place, that's very important to protect against, is there might not be an immediate threat, but there might be a denial of access. In our context here, if there's identity theft, it might change your credit rating, you might not be able to get a bank. In Latin America, what's happened is, through some strange reasoning, the election authorities the election authorities and other bodies sold their data of all the citizens to a huge data company in the United States that then sold it to the Homeland Security Department in the US. And so for some reason, activists in South America can't get visas to the US anymore. And so one really has to be careful in terms of what you have to protect. So I'm going to focus on the developing world, but you have to think of some of the attacks may not be immediate. That can occur over a long period of time. If you're not careful, you're slowly leaking out information about yourself and your organization, and it could have consequences in the future. Some of the tools that come to mind to a lot of people, and I'll go through them relatively quickly, is that it must be recognized that free and open source solutions are probably ideal and most consistent with the philosophy of human rights organizations. The software, but also the key goals that free and open source have, it's very consistent. However, it's not the reality of the organizations. And one cannot just say, oh, just use, you know, NOPIX or use some other distribution instead. You have to help them transition. You have to make the case because these organizations don't have a technology staff. Usually, in many parts of the world, there are no technology consultants that can help them at affordable prices. And so one has to really plan a migration. So one has to deal with the immediate problems and then plan for the longer solutions. So what are some of the immediate solutions that people have thought of and people have used? Email encryption, a lot of organizations now have computers and they're corresponding by email. And something that's more over 10 years old is PGP and the free and open source version, GNUPG, and all the associated plugins. One of the biggest complaints is that it works really well in Latin-based languages. But if you start having accents and other things, depending on the implementation, the accents can be killed, can be distorted, and if you don't know how to configure it properly, you might configure your text of your message really well, but your attachments go completely unencrypted. The user interface isn't necessarily as good as it could be, and there's a lot of steps users have to learn. So a lot of organizations are very enthusiastic. They'll go through trainings. And then if you visit the organizations a year later, the sustainability of the use is really low. And so any solution, and there have been some solutions since that do everything at a background transparently, is much more efficient. A lot of organizations are starting to use webmail. They don't have their own computers. They go to internet cafes. And so if you think about it, the only solution that Yahoo and Gmail and all these other things have HTTPS. But having other things that encrypt the content on a web-based solution, there is one called Hushmail. Unfortunately, it's not free and open source. However, they have been donating premium service accounts to organizations that we deal with. So just like PGP, they're very consistent with these being used for human rights use. Another key problem and a really key challenge are tools that help with backup. People are storing information on their computers, on organization computers, tools that can securely store the information, maybe do a remote backup, is the big challenge. One of the tools that has been developed is something called MARTIS, which is a free and open source tool. For some of the techies here, rsync over SSH is used by some organizations to remotely synchronize their servers with servers outside of the country. However, some of these solutions aren't necessarily the easiest ones that could be. And so one step to go behind, instead of just giving technology and leaving, is building capacity for the people to understand why security, why privacy is important, why it should be made decisions not at a technical level, but the administration of an NGO really has to think it's important. And so organizations where the director of the organization has said, we're going to use PGP always, everyone in the organization does that. If it's left to the technical person, the management has to decide, the management doesn't understand, and within 2 months, it's not being used anymore. So one really has to know how to speak to management, but also education. Ongoing education, both at a distance from people in the north, but also to build a regional capacity. And that's something that hopefully will get more developed in the months to come. So I said one thing that's very important to bridge the divide. And now I'm going to very quickly, once I get a message from the moderator, how much time I have. How much time do I have?
3 to 5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes, okay. So I will be fast. I just want to show some pictures. These are workshops that we've done in Colombia, where after it was a 3-day training session where we had the people themselves, after a day and a half, show each other some of the tools and explain to their colleagues how things were. We usually work in small groups, which is we find more efficient, using their own technology, using their own places of work. Again, small. Some of the organizations, for example, work on forensic anthropology. And these are groups that document how that dig up remains that exist in particular places and document it. And they need to store it in a secure way. There's been some work in Dubai recently, and so it's very important to make sure that tools will work in other languages, because when I was in Dubai, it was a big challenge to find tools that actually worked in Arabic. I'll go through some of them here. One of my most recent trip that's probably in the hottest zone that I've been was in Eastern Congo. And this is a poster that says MONUC, which is the UN monitoring mission in the United Nations, we are with you. And a week after I left, and the UN has these very impressive vehicles that protect us, that are supposed to protect and patrol the streets. Unfortunately, the peacekeepers speak Spanish, and in Eastern Congo, they speak French. So that is a communications problem to begin with. You have signs that there are internet cafes, but to log into Yahoo Mail takes 25 minutes. It's a very beautiful part of the world, where, you know, it looks really nice. This is a workshop where we had where power was intermittent, and most of the training was on how they could deal with security, both at a physical level, but also at a IT level. And so we convened kind of small groups for them to work on particular issues, have them identify what their problems were. Again, we'll go through some pictures. It's very important in certain parts of the country to recognize the dynamics in the country and who the very powerful actors are. So particularly in Guatemala, it's very important to engage women. And I'm a bit disappointed that we don't have more women in the crowd, because those are some of the issues that sometimes in certain parts of the world are very, very sensitive. And so it's very important to address that. So here's just some of the technology. This is one of the airports that we used. And so Goma, the reason why I have Goma here is anyone who's been following some of the news is and over the last 2 weeks, armed groups took over Goma and Bukavu, and places that seemed very peaceful were not, and there were problems. And I'll just go to the last three slides right now and talk about where communications, one has to be very, very careful. Privacy enhancing tools and the use of communications, the case of Rwanda, where radio was used as a way to propagate genocide. And to give you the context of the country, if you're not familiar with Rwanda, in the course of 8 weeks, 1.5 million people were killed. And the state now of Rwanda has very severe intercept capabilities, and they can intercept a lot of things. And these are just some photos from the genocide memorial in Rwanda. And one thing that one should always remember is, here it says, never again. And one has to be very remembering the fact that a lot of the privacy-enhancing technologies, we can talk about technologies, but there's also a human factor. So let's not forget that link, but let's make sure the tools and everything else are mature enough so they can be used not only here, but in other parts of the world with very challenging circumstances. Thank you very much for your time.
So, actually, your last sentence, that these technologies are important for other parts of the world as well, it's been very important, because, I mean, we have seen these pictures of the third world countries. We've seen how important privacy-enhancing technologies are there. And sometimes, by seeing these pictures, we feel very remote, and we feel as if this wasn't really relevant for us. So I would like to ask Roger, you're coming from the US, and the US currently isn't really the country you want to be in for certain reasons, which is this one, for example, privacy. Can you comment on how you see the situation in the US right now in this context?
It's a tough question. From my impression, so what Robert is talking about, in third world countries, there are a lot of issues all around the world where people need to be able to communicate with each other and coordinate without worrying about their government or local organizations knowing what they're doing and keeping track of it. But at the same time, in the more developed countries, not just the US, but in Europe and many other places, there are lots of governments who are becoming, and companies who are becoming very interested in collecting data about citizens and customers and so on to be able to track what sorts of people they are so they can sell things to them better, or to be curious what sorts of news sites they're looking at to try to profile which people are bad people and which people are good people. And there are plenty of issues like this that happen in our countries right now, that we want to develop technologies that can allow individuals to choose how much information about themselves they reveal in their daily lives as they go to Amazon and look at various books or something like that. So, I mean, I don't think it's the U.S. in particular that is comparable to the third world countries. I think all of the countries in the world are comparable to the third world countries insofar as everybody is interested in collecting data about people, and there are a lot of issues surrounding that.
Yeah, I was referring to initiatives in the context of the Homeland Security initiative.
I don't think the Homeland Security Initiative is collecting much more data than they were before.
There's
plenty of publicity, but there was plenty of publicity before. Many countries are collecting a lot of information about a lot of people. And, I mean, if you go to a library right now, you get the same impression that you got before, that of course the librarian wants to help you learn, and of course you're in a place of learning and knowledge, and you have to be aware that the government can go in at any time without telling anybody and figure out which books you've checked out and what you've been reading. I imagine that was the case before also. We just have a couple of laws that make it a bit more explicit now. I mean, we might live in the free society, but there's still a long way to go before it's actually free for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point of view. We actually have two major areas where people are concerned about being tracked. One is obviously, and that's the most important one for those people who use today privacy-enhancing technologies, is that they want to be protected from commercial entities. So the trust or the distrust in commercial entities is much bigger than the trust or distrust in the state.
I should also point out that companies and governments also want privacy-enhancing technologies for this same reason. If I'm a company and I want to look at various competitors, I don't want them to know that I'm doing that. If I'm looking at various people I can buy things from, various procurement people, then I don't want to reveal to my competitors who I'm buying my materials from. If I'm thinking about buying another company and I'm sending mail to their CEO back and forth, I don't want the telephone companies to be able to learn that I'm thinking about transacting with this company. So from one perspective, you can call it privacy, but from the company's perspective, we call it security, and it's the same technologies. And from the government's perspective, we call it traffic analysis resistant communications network. The governments need this, these same technologies, for their national security. And I'll talk a little bit later about how that ties into individuals and governments. But it's not just individuals that care about this.
Yes.